Since 1957, the Germanic-American Institute has been building cultural bridges between the American Midwest and German-speaking European countries. And this is our podcast. We cordially invite you on the inside to join us as we share insights into German grammar, the German cultural experience. We'll look at current topics, and we will let you know all about the events that we are involved in and you can participate in. At times, we will also invite guests on the show who will share their knowledge and experiences with us, and will answer any questions you may have about our content or the GAI itself. Willkommen to the Germanic American Institute podcast.
And here we are, episode 4 of the GAI podcast. Welcome in 2019. Of course, we hope that you had a phenomenal holiday break, Christmas break, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whichever you celebrate, and you made it just fine into 2019. This is the first edition for this year. We have many more planned, of course. We always invite your questions. We get to this in a little bit here down the road. But as usual, I would like to introduce you to the two ladies who, as always, join me on the GAI podcast. We have Claudia.
Guten Tag.
And we have Katrin.
Moin, moin.
Katrin. Moin, moin. I have to pick up on that. As we welcomed our new cohort of 100 students or beginner students yesterday, I talked a lot about different cultural norms and different cultural perspectives. And we dove into the subject matter by saying Guten Tag, which is sort of the usual Guten Tag, welcome, hello, that we can use just about everywhere in Germany as well as in Austria. But I do believe that there are still cultural differences. And one of the things that I've been wondering about is, what does moin moin mean? Where did it originate at? How can we use that? It is rather specific, it seems. And as an Austrian, I actually wouldn't use it. So I'm really interested.
Moin moin is generally used north of Hannover. I think it has a Low German origin. I'm not entirely sure. It does not mean good morning. It just means hi, and you can say it every day, all day.
So it's almost like the Hawaiian aloha, sort of universally
applicable. Yeah.
As we dream of summer, looking outside and it's winter. In any way, today we switch the narrative a little bit. Usually we have a grammar section followed by a cultural section followed by something else. This time we're actually scrapping the grammar section. We go right into two questions that were submitted by our students. And Katrin has the first one.
Yeah, the first question we got was, Germany seems very committed to the creation of the European Union. Is this true? And if yes, why? Yeah, talking about the European Union, Germany is indeed very committed to it. In order to understand really the importance of the concept of the European Union, one needs to go back to the last century. Germany, at the end of World War II and World War I as well, was a first-hand witness to the destructiveness of war, of course. The idea of a European Union started with just 6 countries, Belgium, Germany, France, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. They signed a treaty that would have all coal and steel mining under a joint administration, in order to prevent really another arms race and in order to prevent any one country to produce excessive amounts of arms again. This idea, after it had run for a while successfully, then went on and it merged into the European Economic Union and then eventually into the European Union as we know today. But that still doesn't answer the question why. The short answer as to why really is peace, or the maintenance of peace. The more countries are intertwined with each other, really economically, socially, administratively, you name it, the less likely they are to start wars with each other, of course, because the more they have to lose. As a result, we have had over 70 years of peace on German soil. People are starting to forget what a precious good that really is, and the trauma of war has been passed down through the generations. My kids really are the first generation now that does not have direct contact with people anymore that lived through it. It is easy to forget that when one is confronted with the seemingly dysfunctional aspect, such as the famous headlines, I don't know if you remember that, about how the EU is regulating how curved a cucumber can be. Yet despite these annoyances, we have had the longest peace and prosperity phase in the last 500 years. And that is really something that's quite significant. The EU is about relationship building. There are high school and university exchange programs such as Erasmus and Comenius, amongst others, which are enabling young people to forge personal relationships with members of other cultures and countries. The EU also spends significant amounts of money abroad, trying to help other countries to build stable economies and societies. About 140 million people are helped every year directly by EU funds. That makes the EU and its member countries the biggest provider of humanitarian aid in the world. Yet this aid breaks down to less than 1% of the budget and is at about 2 euros per person. Now, this is all fine and dandy. However, this is not because Europeans have higher morale than anyone else. It is because wars, economic instability, and disparity lead to social unrest, something most centrist-minded people and their families would like to avoid. Social justice and fairness is not just a concept for do-gooders. It can be, of course, but there are some very real benefits for all of us. As anyone is talking about a bloated administration in Brussels, only 6% of the annual budget of the EU goes to administration and personnel. If we compare that, for example, with the city of Munich, there it is about 40%. I don't think anyone claims that the EU is perfect. It's a work in progress. However, with the election of right-wing xenophobic politicians worldwide and also in Europe, the EU, in my opinion, is needed as much as ever. And as a final clarification about the curvature of cucumbers, that was not something a faceless bureaucrat dreamt up during a sleepless night. It was actually a request by a trade organization because it makes packing and shipping cucumbers easier and more efficient. And that rule has since been abandoned.
So now we can do cucumbers in any curvature we want.
In any shape.
I feel so much better already, yes.
And I think, interestingly, I looked up a couple little facts about the EU as well, since we were going to talk about this. And there are over 500 million citizens that are served by the, that are, or not served, that are part of EU member countries. So, and as such, it is the largest single market in the world. Because with this, you know, comes, you know, free or somewhat free and unlimited flow of goods and services, right? Because the borders were opened up as part of the EU and then the Schengen Agreement, and more countries are joining. So now you have a space or an area with well over 500 million people. So,
and 60% of its good really go to the domestic market of the European Union.
Right. So it makes, you know, it makes a huge combined domestic market. And, you know, the other thing that I think the three of us have experience with, I remember as a kid when we used to go on vacation to Italy and we still had the Deutschmark and we had to drive through Austria, then we brought some Austrian shillings, and then going into Italy we had about 30 million lira because the exchange rates were so different. And now part of the European Union is also a monetary union where not all countries participate, but, you know, quite a large number now have the euro, and, you know, that helps as well.
It's quite interesting, having visited Prague a couple of years back, just to be able to drive from Vienna to Prague and not having to stop at the border, and for the first time truly recognizing that a country that used to be behind the Iron Curtain and was pretty much sealed off from us, we could just simply drive into, and within 2.5 hours, roughly 3 hours, we managed to get from Vienna to Prague, which, by the way, is a phenomenal city. But just really the ease of movement, if you will, across country lines is particularly significant. And what it sort of brought up in my mind was the idea of this tribal proverb, if you will, that says, if you want to go fast, you go alone, but if you want to go farther, you want to go together. Which, in that sense of economic development, of opportunities across borders, makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that not just from an intercompetitive perspective within Europe to just open up the borders and open up trade and open up opportunities, but also from a global stage where Germany has phenomenal products, so does Austria and all the other European Union member countries. It just makes a lot of sense to work together as opposed to just closing the country off and playing upon their own rules. Now, the problem with it is that those who have knee-jerk reactions with big governments would come along and say, well, we don't want big government. We don't want big representation and big representing bodies. But at the same time, when you look at how much good is actually being done by the individual representation and then the collective representation in Brussels, it makes a lot of sense to have this united representation. So why is Germany interested in the European Union? I think for the same reason that Austria is interested in the European Union. And it's going to be very interesting to see what the UK, what Britain does with their Brexit, whether they actually truly are exiting, or if they try to exit in a way that they keep the best benefits out of the European Union, having recognized how beneficial it truly is, or if they turn around and say, you know what, actually it's much better to be part of this tribe rather than living in isolation, especially considering that they're already on an island. Jury is out what it means to them and what it means essentially for us, because it's obviously unprecedented. But on the whole, I'd say there is a lot more upside to the European Union than there is downside.
Well, and I think, you know, speaking about Brexit and the UK trying to leave, that's why it's been taking so long, because of these negotiations that are taking part, because they don't just want to cut all ties. Mm-hmm. They still want to have some of the trade benefits that come as, you know, along with being part of the European Union. So they want to get out. And by the way, the UK never adopted the euro, so they've always kept their pound sterling as their currency. So it's almost like, well, they kind of want out, but then they still want the benefits as if they were part of it. And that's why I think some of these negotiations and contracts and those kinds of things are still taking so long, because, you know, they really still want to be able to trade and have agreements with the rest of the countries of the European Union, because now instead of then just one trading partner, if they were going to have treaties and contracts with everybody else, they'd have to make contracts with, I don't know how many countries are in the EU, 26, 28, 28. Whatever,
28.
Right? Yeah, so you pick. The downside, though, with, you know, those open borders is, you know, and there are many people that have challenged that, is especially once that expansion to the east happened with, you know, Czech Republic and Romania and some of those countries that used to be behind the Iron Curtain, that you now have maybe workers who, you know, who are flooding the markets, or who are flooding the employment scene in central and northern Europe, and, you know, kind of driving competition between workers, and, you know, they're willing to maybe do it for lower wages or those kinds of things. Plus, you know, does it dilute the unique cultural aspects of each country now that you no longer have a border that defines you, who you are and what you do? Right. I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because that's some of the naysayers with the European Union saying, you know.
I think it's interesting to see that now that Brexit has been talked about for so long. And I mean, really, the US had a rough decade with Greece and Italy and, you know, countries.
The US, EU.
EU has had a rough decade economically. But it seems that with Brexit being discussed, a lot of the other members have actually come to see, oh, maybe it's not such a bad thing. And in my opinion, the EU is now stronger than it was before.
Yeah, but there's still four or five countries, half a dozen countries waiting to get in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like there's this big exodus happening because the UK is now leaving, that all the countries want to leave. There's still a bunch of countries waiting to get in.
Well, to the point that you made earlier in terms of foreign labor coming across now open borders, so let's just say somebody from Slovenia, which was the most recent adopted country into the European Union, a healthcare worker, let's just say a nurse, comes to Germany or Austria to actually provide services within the healthcare system. Their education is on par, their ethics and morals, I'm assuming, are on par as well, otherwise they wouldn't be hired. But they are willing and capable to lift an amount of work and move the ball forward, so to speak, that some Germans and Austrians may have come a little complacent about. And with that complacency comes the fear of saying, well, there are foreign workers coming in and taking my jobs. Now, the nurse example perhaps was a little hyperbolized, if you will, but there are many lower wage jobs that Austrians are, for instance, too essentially good to be actually doing those. And when the janitorial staff does their job, where the Austrian says, you know what, I'm above this, which is fine, you can certainly be above that, but if that's the case, you also shouldn't necessarily complain simultaneously about foreign workers coming in, picking up the slack that you actually left off. So it's not unknown to the U.S. either. We have the same type of argument with foreign labor coming into the U.S., but then again, who is going to pick the avocados in Southern California, right? We are not going to volunteer for that. So we need that exchange of labor. We need the exchange of services. Now, how that should be regulated, good question. I'm definitely not a specialist in that, but I would say, to touch back on what Catherine said earlier, the European Union is a phenomenal experiment. It is an experiment that's actually gone right, but it's not gone 100% right. I don't think there is such a thing as 100% in that instance. It's just really work in progress, continuous work in progress. And that work is only possible if we all work together, because otherwise this is inevitably going to fall apart.
Yep, and to Katrin's point earlier, right? I mean, I don't think many Americans realize how much war there has been on the European continent. And, you know, there were wars all the time. All of us who've gone to school in Europe have learned about all of those in our history lessons, you know, and there were constant battles and constant wars even before the countries were formed the way they exist now. You know, all the kings and royals used to fight each other, and then, you know, world wars and things like that. So that is a huge consideration, you know, as Katrin says, maintaining the peace. And with peace, you maintain more economic stability and exchange and collaboration. And, you know, the U.S. really has only ever had one big war fought here, you know, or maybe a few, but, you know, no, the world wars were not really touching the U.S. other than Hawaii. And, you know, so there were civil wars and other things here, but they never led to that really broad destruction that we've seen in Europe.
I mean, we've had two world wars, both on European soil. And I think even though humankind is prone to repeat history as often as we can, expecting different results, realizing, well, hang on a second, they are probably not different, we may have finally learned after the second one to say, perhaps we don't want a third one. So that touches back to what you said, leading the entire European Union setup, if you will, just to control this race to arms and to fight one another, which is just an idiotic aspect of non-collaboration, obviously. We've learned from that to some degree. Then, of course, the question is, have we really? And going back to the conversation that I had with Fred Amram in our special that we posted a couple of weeks ago, where he says, well, it looks awfully like we're going back to what used to be 1930. And if that's the case, from somebody who's lived through that, we might really want to pay attention as to what the developments currently are. So there's a little bit of a warning flag in this as well.
Absolutely.
And on that high note.
Yes. Yay, aren't you glad you asked that question?
No, thank you, of course, for the question.
Thank
please
you.
Keep them coming. Let me just plug this real quick. If you do have any questions that you want us to consider and talk about within our scope of, let's say, insights, please email them to language@gai-mn.org. And with that, we just seamlessly move into question number two. And Claudia has the question.
Yeah, so this is another interesting question that we received from one of our language students. And the question is, what do German-speaking or German native people really think of their German, Swiss, and Austrian American counterparts who identify with that heritage? So basically saying, you know, what do we think if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I'm German too. And then once you start talking to them, you realize that they're actually, you know, four generations removed from being German because their great-great-great-grandfather came over. Or same with Austrian or same with Swiss. And how do we feel about that? And that's a really interesting question because, you know, as a native-born German, I, you know, having lived here in the United States, actually most of my adult life, or all of my adult life, but most of my life overall, I still identify as German. But, you know, that's because I was born there. And it would never occur to me to that somebody that I would identify as American multiple generations out or as German multiple generations out. So it's kind of an interesting thing. On one hand, you know, I think it is because the US is a land of immigrants and people all came from somewhere. Many of them obviously from Europe, many of them from Germany in multiple waves of immigration. So in a way it's kind of cool that you want to be German, but you know, do you really understand what all of that means? You know, do you bring, you know, do you take responsibility for these world wars that we just talked about or some of the other things that happened? Or, you know, how far back do you want to go? I mean, it's just, you know, at which point are you no longer just German or it's, I don't know. It's
a tough one.
It's a tough one.
Katrin, what do you think?
It is a tough one, and it's a whole can of worms that we are opening here. It has occurred to me over the past 20 or so years that I've been here that really Americans and Germans, or, you know, Europeans presumably, have a completely different angle on this question. So I think in Germany, for somebody to say I'm German is really a way of including oneself in a group that shares, you know, cultural, language, characteristics, really where we are all coming from, where we were born, where we were raised. While in the United States, it serves as distinguishing yourself from someone. You know, we're a lot of people here, and what makes me different is that I am German by heritage, for example. And what is very obvious to me at this point, after thinking about this now for a little bit, is that we're talking about two completely different things. And I think it's really a matter of miscommunication, because the same word just doesn't, you know, have the same connotations for somebody that was actually born in a certain country and somebody that's a couple generations removed by it from it.
That's a really good point, yeah.
But inevitably, since the question was asked by an American, we would have to adopt sort of the American perspective on that, right? Or are we looking at it from the European angle, which is essentially fundamentally different, like you just said. So we're sort of almost, not that we clash in the middle, but we perhaps are not on the same page with
exactly.
That.
There's very much a difference in perception. And I don't know that we need to, you know, adopt American or the Americans need to adopt the European perspective. I think with so many other things, it's just good to be aware of that there are cultural differences. And I used to have and still have a little bit this attitude as well, like, okay, you say you're German, but really what is it that makes you German? Because you haven't ever lived in Germany or you certainly weren't born there. And the Christmas pickle that you stick in your tree actually is not German either.
No.
Maybe it's the wrong angle of questioning that. Maybe it's just something that, yeah, people use to distinguish themselves from other people that, you know, live in the same society that they live in.
And maybe people just want to know where they come from, right? Because as Germans, we inherently know where we come from, right? We can usually trace our heritage back multiple generations, you know, multiple generations. And we know that we're German and our grandparents were Germans and our great-grandparents and our great-great-great-great-great. I mean, we can usually trace it back. In the U.S., it's not like that. And in U.S., you often find that mix, like whether it's, you know, Irish-American, German-American, Polish-American, African-American, right? I mean, you find these hyphenates quite often. Mm-hmm. And we don't have those in Germany. I mean, I unless I'm missing something, we don't, you know, my family, my dad's side of the family came from France a long time ago, but we don't say we're French German. We're German, you know, because that's where we, you know, we don't hyphenate that.
If so many people come to form a different or a new country that really doesn't go back that far, right. There might also be some sort of cultural vacuum that needs to be filled. And by going back to one's roots, so to speak, that could be an attempt to fill it. I mean, I've noticed something along those lines for myself as well. I've never been more German than I have become here in Minnesota.
yeah.
And I think there is something about knowing where you come from and knowing who you are, and it defines just so many things about oneself.
See, I'm a little less political correct, I guess, with my answer here, in a sense that if you were to tell me, hey, I'm Austrian too, as an American four times removed, if you will, then my immediate response would be, no, you're not. But before you have a knee-jerk reaction and turn us off, let me explain. by happenstance, and just simply by the way you grew up, where you were born, how you essentially made your living here, you were defined and shaped by American cultural values. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that those values are, to some degree, fundamentally different than Austrian and German and Swiss and so forth values. So just simply by cultural immersion and cultural mandates, you simply cannot be Austrian. However, the caveat to this would be, if you are 23andMe or your ancestry DNA results come back, and let's just pick up on the arbitrary number of 60% of your DNA is Austrian, and they can even pinpoint it down that you are perhaps Viennese, at which point I want to high-five you, because welcome to Vienna. but at the same time, I would want to say now you truly have justifiable reason to say, here is the predominant load, so to speak, of my DNA that says I am from X and Y. So I want to chase down where I really truly come from. And I think this is where your journey starts. Now, you can't deny, under no circumstances, that you are American simply because this is how you grew up. Just as I cannot deny I'm Austrian because this is how I grew up. This is how my worldview was shaped. But if my DNA results were to come back to say I'm 60% Polish, I'd be hiking over to Poland trying to figure out what the heck is going on. So I would encourage everybody who gets their results back, and I think this question may be informed by the idea that something along the way gave you an idea, gave you a clue that you are from somewhere in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, perhaps Northern Italy. By all means, go down that path and figure out where you actually came from, where your family came from, what is all this about? And in the process of doing this, inevitably, you're going to pick up the culture, perhaps to the degree that we, the three of us perhaps find ourselves in that we've become sort of a hybrid model, if you will. I still identify as Austrian, I always will, but I also identify as American to some degree while I'm here in operational mode. I think in English, I dream in English, I operate in English, unless I'm teaching German, but it has shaped me, it has changed me, but it's also, much like Catherine, giving me a much greater appreciation of Austria itself. So the direct answer to this question is no, until you make it a yes.
Yeah, that's...
So no, you're not Austrian until you become one, so to speak.
Yeah, and you're not Australian either, right? Because, I mean, that's the other part. Austria is not the same as Australia.
You know, honestly, I'm not sure who's at fault to that. I want to say Jim Carrey with Dumb and Dumber, right?
Maybe.
That's when it started. And I've since, by some of my very sarcastic friends in North Dakota, picked up the nickname of Rue, which... That's a story for another day.
Yeah.
Okay. But anything else we want to add to this?
I think, you know, we obviously aren't going to be rude, as you said, you know, with, no, you're not this or that. But, you know, I really appreciate the thought or the suggestion of, you know, if you do identify with that heritage and if you do find out from your ancestry or whatever, you know, 23andMe test results that you are a large portion of something, mm-hmm. then do go there. Yes, do go there or come here and learn about the culture and, you know, really find out what it means to be that and you know what the experiences are. And I think that's really an awesome suggestion, because you're not going to learn more about the country or where your ancestors came from by maybe, you know, tracking down the village where they lived and, you know, that kind of stuff. So
be prepared if you go to, you know, Europe, Germany. I don't know for sure how it is in Austria, but in Germany for sure, that people are going to be a little bit confused as to what you're doing. This whole ancestry.com really got a bad, you know, taste during the Nazi time, when everybody had to go back, I don't know, 2-3 generations to prove that there was no Jewish influence. And as Claudia said before, most people can track their ancestry back to the 1600s, to the 30-year war, where a lot of church documents were destroyed. But yeah, don't be surprised if people at first are a little bit like, what are you doing here and why are you doing this?
Yeah,
it's not as popular as it is here.
It's not as commonplace. But also to that degree, just perhaps as a final thought on this, would be that you don't have to identify as one of us to still at all times be welcome by all of
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yep.
I just made that up.
No, and
on
that's
on the spot.
Fantastic. And actually, you're going to start seeing, when you do come to the GAI, where you're going to start seeing some statements around that, because we've actually started thinking about what does it mean to be connected to German culture. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, you know, engineering, if you think about science, if you think about music, if you think about art, if you think about beer, if you think about a lot of different things, you know, that does connect you to Germanic or German culture, because there's a huge influence here in the U.S. even, you know, from things that originated in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, right?
Do you like Christmas? Well, then you're connected to German culture.
Yeah, you like a Tannenbaum, yeah, or Krampus, or you know, Amadeus, you know, Rachmi Amadeus, he was Austrian. And so, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that has shaped a global and, you know, especially here, U.S. culture, because it did come from Europe and from Germanic-speaking countries. So to whichever degree, we're all connected to it. Some of us, you know, because we were born there, others because we have some heritage, and others because we have certain interests.
All right. Phenomenal question. Obviously, you can easily get us to discuss for what probably could go on for hours. But in the interest of time, we'll cut this one as we are and move right into the next section. It's all about events and dates, and Claudia has the details.
So as we said, you know, there are many programs and events coming up now that we started 2019. So our cultural programming is actually going to focus on the theme Das moderne Deutschland, or modern Germany. And we're going to kick it off this Saturday, January 12th, and hopefully you hear this before then, with a talk here at the GAI in the ballroom at 11 a.m. called Yearning for Freedom, Community and Individualism in Germany. Another cultural aspect, right? We struggle to toe that line between, you know, individual rights versus community rights. European Union, you know, is the government overreaching in Germany? Is, you know, those kinds of things. So interesting talk by Dr. Heino Beckmann. He is a professor emeritus from the University of St. Thomas. He also was the honorary consul to Germany. Fantastic talk, January 12th, 11 a.m. at the GAI, and it is free. Now, if you're, after all this talk, you're interested to learn German, because you want to learn the language and the culture, whether it be German, Swiss, Austrian, Tyrolean, Liechtenstein, you know, pick. There are several parts of the world that do speak German that are not those three countries.
We do not yet teach Tyrolean. Swiss German, right?
Well, their official language is German, not Swiss, not Schweizerdeutsch, but yeah. We have classes starting in February. All that information is on our website. But if you're not quite sure, you know, what you're getting yourself into, we have a Schnupperkurs. introduction to German, and let that be the first word you learn, Schnupperkurs. It's Schnupperkurs means sniffing something out, you know, exploring something. And it's introduction to German. It's a two-hour class on Saturday, January 26th. And in true German form, we will feed you. That is one thing you will learn. We like food. We like to drink. We like to get together with food and drink. And so it's Saturday, January 26th, and it's combined with our Kaffeestube breakfast. So you pay a fee of $25. That gets you free breakfast and then a two-hour class from 10 to noon to learn about our German classes. If you have children that are interested in learning German, we do have Saturday school classes starting this week as well, and there are still spots available. We have classes for children as young as 4 that don't speak any German, all the way up through elementary school, middle school, and high school at various level of German skills and experience, and that is called Samstagsschule or Saturday school. And those classes also begin this Saturday, January 12th. All the information is on our website. And if you, you know, miss the first week, no worries. You can continue to sign up throughout the session. And, you know, maybe your children are interested. Speaking of children, believe it or not, even though we just started the new year and kids just got back to school, there is a school release day on Monday, January 21st. And it is Martin Luther King holiday. And for that holiday, we actually have a workshop planned. It's called German and Science Solar Power. So your children will learn about solar power. They will learn some German words, even though the class is mostly taught in English, to make sure the children understand all the concepts. But they will learn about solar power. They will learn German words about solar power. And that workshop is available for kids kindergarten through fourth grade. Information can be found on our website. German and Science Workshop, Martin Luther King School Release Day, January 21st. And if you feel like you're lucky and you want to have a little bit of fun, next week, January 19th, our beer and bingo fundraiser, Summit Brewery Ratskeller. So Summit Brewery Ratskeller. Beer and bingo. What can be more fun than playing some bingo and drinking some good beer? And that is a fundraiser for the GEI. So while it is held at the Summit Brewery Ratskeller, it is a fundraiser for the GEI, and you're, of course, supporting a great cause. Again, that is on January 19th, beer and bingo at the Summit Brewery Ratskeller. All that information is available on our website, whether it's classes, events, programs, breakfast, food, whatever, at our website, www.gai-mn.org.
Stacked full program.
Absolutely.
So everybody is hopping and we're busy, which is a great problem to have. Well, that was it. First episode of 2019. Not too bad. Great questions. Really great questions.
Keep them coming.
Yes, please do. Once again, our email address where you can submit your questions to is language@gai-mn.org. Again, it's language@gai-mn.org. With this, we are wrapping episode 4. Looking forward to episode 5. Let's see what we can cook up or what you actually present us with. So if you want us to not reflect on grammar, send questions in. That's the surefire way. That's it. We are signing off, and we'll talk with you soon.
Tschüss, Ade.
Tschüss.